Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrock. First on this week's program, Valley Rewind, the 8 biggest Phoenix news stories of 2024. This story was written by Zach Buchanan and TJ LeHeroux and was published in the print edition of the Phoenix New Times on December 26th. This year was a blur. Globally, a war raged in Gaza. Nationally, one presidential candidate survived an assassination attempt, while another dropped out of the race at the last minute. Then, we had the actual election, which Donald Trump comfortably won to secure another 4 years in the White House. In Phoenix, the year was every bit as consequential. So, as we close the book on 2024, here's a look back at the 8 biggest news stories in the Valley this year. A change of guard in the Senate. Until April, the Senate race in Arizona looked like it would be a messy one. Senator Kyrsten Sinema was still seeking re-election, but this time as an independent. Democratic Representative Ruben Gallego had entered the race to challenge her from the left, while Republican Kerry Lake was mounting another attempt at winning a statewide office. It was a difficult race to handicap. Then, Sinema dropped out, setting up a showdown between Gallego and Lake. An erstwhile liberal firebrand, Gallego tacked to the center, taking a harder line on the border and cozying up to the police union. Lake had more difficulty casting herself as a moderate, mired as she was in her own unlikability and her legal challenges over the 2022 election. In the end, Gallego beat Lake by a wider margin than Governor Katie Hobbs had 2 years ago, keeping both of Arizona's Senate seats in Democratic hands. Arizona goes red. As a critical battleground state, all eyes were on Arizona in November. Not only was the state a critical campaign spot for the Trump and Democratic presidential nominations, but local Democrats also hoped to win majorities in both houses of the Arizona legislature, neither of which they had controlled for more than 30 years. But on election night, it quickly became clear that Republicans had achieved solid victories at almost every level of government. Trump rocked Harrison, Arizona, which wasn't even called yet when major news outlets projected him as the next president. Trump's stunningly large victory likely impacted down-ballot races as state Republicans in swing districts narrowly beat out Democrats to gain even more seats in both the Senate and House. They even won all three seats up for grabs on the Arizona Corporation Commission, despite deep social dissatisfaction with the high energy bills over which the GOP-controlled commission has influence. Strangely, all that talk about the 2024 election being rigged against Republicans evaporated into mist after November 5th. We can only wonder why. Squabbling over the death penalty. When the year began, Arizona wasn't planning on executing anyone. After taking office in 2023, Hobbs and Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays hit pause on capital punishment in the state following a series of botched executions under former Governor Doug Ducey. They ordered an independent review of the state's execution process and said the state wouldn't seek death warrants until that review was completed. Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell, a Republican, didn't like that. In May, Mitchell publicly admonished Mays for not seeking a death warrant for prisoner Aaron Gunches. In June, Mitchell announced she'd seek a death warrant for Gunches herself, setting up a constitutionality battle about whether a county attorney can even do that. The showdown may be moot now, though. Another controversy has risen to take its place. In November, Hobbs canned retired federal judge David Duncan, whom she'd tasked with reviewing Arizona's death penalty practices. She said Duncan's report, which was nearing completion, had overstepped his mandate by saying that lethal injection could not be conducted humanely, while also advocating for a firing squad, which is illegal under Arizona law. And with that, Arizona's pause on the death penalty ended. Mays announced that she will seek a death warrant for Gunches, and controversy over the death penalty will persist into 2025. Phoenix Police's unflattering close-up. The Phoenix Police Department spent most of this year in hot water, culminating with the U.S. Department of Justice concluding its three-year investigation into the notoriously brutal force. The report found Phoenix Police frequently committed civil rights violations by discriminating against people of color, using excessive and unnecessarily deadly force, and arresting unhoused people without cause. Since the beginning of the year, the city has attempted to avoid any accountability for its police force. In January, Mayor Kate Gallego and city council members made a coordinated effort to fend off any independent oversight that the DOJ would find necessary, 5 months before the feds even finished their investigation. Shortly after, the director of Phoenix's Police Accountability Agency, Roger Smith, resigned, saying that the city had undercut his ability to do his job. In August, after the DOJ had released its report, two Phoenix cops beat and tased a deaf black man with cerebral palsy. The video of that incident made national news when it was revealed in October. As of December 20th, Phoenix police also had shot and killed 14 people in 2024, an increase from last year's count of 12 and 2022's tally of 10. A homelessness crisis worsens. There was some good news regarding homelessness in the Valley in 2024. In January, when Maricopa County conducted its point-in-time count of unhoused people, there was a slight reduction in the number of people experiencing homelessness, though that tally still verges on 10,000. What's more, a higher percentage of people were sheltered and not on the street than in 2023. That's where the good news ended. In June, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Grants Pass v. Johnson that municipalities can criminalize sleeping outside even when a person has nowhere else to go. That ruling opened the doors for cities and towns to trample the rights of the unhoused, and many local governments rushed through it. Phoenix passed new camping bans, and Tempe announced its intention to step up enforcement of the bans it had on the books. In November, Arizona voters passed Proposition 312, which prods cities to enforce public nuisance laws to avoid being sued for property tax refunds. The result, advocates fear, will be more people on the street and fewer resources to help them. It was a hot-ass year. Even if it's no surprise to those living in the Valley, this past summer was the hottest on record, according to the National Weather Service. The average temperature over June, July, and August was 99 degrees, topping 2023's scorching seasonal average of 97 degrees. And the severe heat lasted well past summer. Hiking trails on Piestewa Peak and Camelback Mountain remained closed into October. In 2023, 645 people died as a result of the heat, according to the Maricopa County Department of Public Health. As of October 26th of this year, Maricopa County confirmed at least 466 heat-related deaths, with another 191 under investigation, meaning the final tally will likely be close to last year's shocking figure. That's despite the city and county providing additional cooling facilities with expanded hours for unhoused people. Of the 466 confirmed deaths, nearly half were among those experiencing homelessness. For decades, Phoenix has struggled to get a tree planting effort off the ground to alleviate the urban heat island effect. This fall, the city renewed an effort to plant more shade trees. Abortion is enshrined in the state constitution. A collective panic pulsed through the state on April 9th when the Arizona Supreme Court decided to reinstate an 1864 territorial law banning abortion in nearly all situations, including in cases of rape and incest. The Civil War era law was repealed in the Arizona legislature within a month and never went into effect, but the ruling had ramifications in November. Even before the decision to reinstate the 1864 law, abortion was a front and center political issue. Ever since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, Democrats and Republicans have battled over the future of abortion in the state. That culminated in a massive ballot measure campaign to enshrine the right to an abortion until fetal viability, usually 23 or 24 weeks, into the state constitution. That amendment made it onto the ballot and passed with an overwhelming 60% of votes, making it difficult for state legislators to change. However, nothing is ever truly ironclad. A series of lawsuits will need to strike down Arizona's existing abortion laws, and abortion advocates are preparing to defend abortion rights against efforts by Trump and his allies to curtail them. Arizona State shocks the college football world. Little was expected of the Sun Devils in 2024. A year earlier, ASU had gone a measly 3-9 under first-year head coach Kenny Dillingham. The program was still dealing with the penalties and fallout of the recruiting scandals of Herm Edwards, Dillingham's predecessor. ASU was moving into the Big 12 Conference and was picked to finish dead last. How wrong that was. As of this writing, ASU's football season isn't over. The Sun Devils stunned their way to a Big 12 title behind Dillingham and transfers Sam Levitt and Cam Scataboo, the latter of whom finished fifth in the voting for the Heisman Trophy Award. On January 1st, ASU will play its first college football playoff game, hoping to continue its Cinderella story and route to a national title. In a middling sports year in the Valley, one that featured the departure of the Coyotes, the Diamondbacks choking their way out of a playoff spot, a mediocre Cardinals team, and a Sun squad that never quite seems to have all the pieces it needs, the Sun Devils are easily the biggest success story. Next, a story written by T.J. LeHeru and posted on December 26th. Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport Shooting. What to know? Chaos overtook Terminal 4 of Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport during the late hours of Christmas Day when gunshots rang out near a restaurant outside of a security checkpoint. Here's what to know about the incident. What prompted the Phoenix Sky Harbor shooting? Phoenix police said the incident was a domestic argument turned violent. I do believe that this was a family dispute that escalated, Phoenix Police Sergeant Mayra Reason said at a press conference Thursday morning. Phoenix police said in a press release that the group of people who were involved in the incident all knew each other and that a physical altercation escalated to a person taking out a gun and then shooting a woman and a teenage boy. Concealed weapons are permitted outside of airport security checkpoints in Arizona. Was anybody hurt in the Phoenix Sky Harbor shooting? Two men and one woman were shot, while the male who allegedly fired the gun was stabbed by the teenage boy during the incident. Later, the man who allegedly fired was found with a young girl in the airport's parking lot. The people who suffered gunshot wounds were taken to a local hospital. The woman is in critical but stable condition, according to police. The three men had non-life-threatening injuries and were released and interviewed by detectives. Was anyone arrested for the Phoenix Sky Harbor shooting? Police said they detained two people, though the department declined to release their names to Phoenix New Times. However, arrests have not yet been made. After consultation with the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, no arrests have been made as the investigation remains active, said Phoenix Police Spokesperson Sergeant Phil Krinsky. A charging decision will be made once the investigation is complete. The X account at It's All Phoenix 2, which crowdsources video submissions, posted a video at 10:30 p.m. of a shirtless man sitting on the ground, presumably detained, while Phoenix police officers speak with each other. How long was Phoenix Sky Harbor shut down? A shelter-in-place order was issued immediately after the shooting, though it was lifted around 10:30 p.m., according to Fox 10. At 11:18 p.m., Phoenix police posted on X that operations at Sky Harbor had resumed to normal business. Shortly after, the department added that there were no active threats at the airport. Did anything else odd happen at Phoenix Sky Harbor? Weirdly, yes. Around 10:25 p.m., a 21-year-old man named Cole Neenan showed up carrying multiple guns, according to police. Neenan was apparently told by a relative, erroneously, that there was an active shooter at the airport, prompting him to come with weapons to the airport. Police said he handed his firearms to other individuals at the airport before he approached an officer who was posted just outside the shooting scene. After an altercation with officers, in which police said he struck and spat on one, Neenan was wrestled to the ground and arrested. The Arizona Republic published pictures of Neenan being escorted by police while he is shirtless, barefoot, and handcuffed. Police said they recovered three firearms. Police have charged him with aggravated assault on an officer. State senator sees Kwanzaa display at the Capitol, gets a bit racist. T.J. Shope called the African-American holiday fake, anti-American, and anti-Christian. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and posted on December 27th. In a week filled with celebration and time with loved ones, Republican State Senator T.J. Shope couldn't get through the holiday season without posting something racist. On Thursday, Shope, who represents parts of Pinell, Pima, and Maricopa counties, posted a photo of Governor Katie Hobbs' Kwanzaa display at the Capitol. Above it, he labeled the African-American holiday as a, quote, fake anti-American, anti-Christian holiday. Shope did not immediately respond to Phoenix New Times' request for comment. Darlene Little, the owner of Afrosoul Education Center, a black business incubator and community hub for arts and culture, set up a Kwanzaa display at the Capitol last year. One of its businesses put up the display in 2024. "It's just informative for people who want to hear it," Little said of the displays. "Nobody makes you go. Nobody makes you listen." Kwanzaa is not a religious holiday. It was created in 1966 by author and activist Maulana Ron Karenja, the current chair of the Africana Studies Program at California State University, Long Beach. Kwanzaa is a cultural holiday during which African Americans celebrate their culture, including the principles of unity and self-love. Each day of Kwanzaa, which spans from December 26th to January 1st, Afrosoul celebrates by gathering community members and lighting a candle that begins a discussion about the, quote, thought for the day, or about the corresponding seven essential principles of Kwanzaa. Attendees then eat a little food, and that's about it, said Little. The final day culminates in a communal feast. Little chose not to get worked up about Shope's comments. "That's his personal opinion, and he has a right to it," she said, noting that African Americans no longer need Anglo people to co-sign everything that we do, or approve it, or even understand it. But Patience Ogunbanjo, who owns the Nigerian food truck Laskidi Cafe, called Shope's post dismissive, a bit prejudiced, and said it could be defined as racist. She said, "It reflects the misunderstanding of the profound culture and the cultural significance of Kwanzaa for a lot of African Americans, not only in Phoenix, not only in Arizona, but across the United States. As for the idea that Kwanzaa is somehow anti-Christian, Ogunbanjo noted that Kwanzaa is not considered a substitute for religious holidays, such as Christmas. Instead, she and Little stress that the celebration is meant to uplift the values in African American and black communities. It's a community celebration about life, culture, and love, Little said. I don't know how anybody can be opposed to that. You don't have to celebrate it. You don't have to see it. You don't have to do anything with it. If you do want to celebrate it, though, we'll have that opportunity in Phoenix this year. AfroSoul is hosting its first Kwanzaa Cultural Festival from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Saturday in its parking lot, located downtown at 1145 East Washington Street. It's past due time, said Ojumbanjo, who is an event organizer. Here's a story written by T.J. LeHeru and posted on December 23rd. Trump endorsed Karen Taylor Robeson for governor. His base freaked out. President-elect Donald Trump has already made a prospective endorsement in the 2026 race for governor of Arizona, and the state's extreme right figures are livid. Speaking at Turning Point USA's annual America Fest convention Sunday in Phoenix, Trump signaled his support for Karen Taylor Robeson. A conventional Republican, Robeson lost the gubernatorial primary in 2022 to Kari Lake, who went on to lose to now Governor Katie Hobbs. With Lake now tabbed to head up Voice of America in the next Trump administration, though that appointment is not as clear-cut as Lake and Trump have suggested, the incoming president threw his support behind Lake's 2022 primary challenger. If you do run for governor, Trump told Robeson from the stage, you're going to have my support. As the former and future president's statement suggests, Robeson has not officially jumped into the race, but she responded shortly afterward with a grateful post on X. The endorsement ignited fury among the MAGA crowd, who painted Robeson as a moderate Republican. While up in arms about the decision, few were able to overcome their obsequious fealty to Trump, the party's God-King. Instead, the fault for the endorsement was laid at the feet of some unnamed staffers who surely were pouring poison into Trump's ear. That raises an interesting theoretical question. Who decides what is MAGA enough? Is it Trump, the movement's leader? Or is it whatever Trump's extremist fans believe he should want? Here are some of the biggest meltdowns from Arizona MAGA figures over Trump's endorsement. State Senator Jake Hoffman. Donald Trump should fire whichever consultant or staffer told him to endorse the uniparty McCain Network candidate for AZ governor. She lost the 2022 primary for a reason. Arizona doesn't want her open borders, pro-amnesty, liberal policies. KTR is the swamp. Unable to criticize the infallible supreme leader of the GOP, Hoffman, a Queen Creek Republican and leader of the far-right Freedom Caucus, blamed a Trump consultant or staffer for the endorsement. Hoffman was one of the 11 fake electors who tried to overturn the results of the 2020 election for Trump. State Representative Jacqueline Parker. Trump's AZ endorsements have messed up our state so many times. He needs to just focus on Congress and stay out of our statewide races. Parker's tone was more overtly critical of Trump, saying he needed to stay out of our statewide races. Laura Loomer. Hey, Karen, why are you pretending to be a Trump supporter? And who on Team Trump told President Trump to endorse Trump hater Karen Taylor Robeson for governor of Arizona? Karen, you literally held fundraisers for Trump hater Chris Christie's failed 2024 presidential campaign against Trump. Here's the receipt of the fundraiser invitation with Karen's name on it. Trump should immediately rescind his endorsement of K. Taylor Robeson. Loomer is an Arizona native, outspoken media personality, and self-described white nationalist. She gained attention during the presidential election when she frequently was spotted with Trump. She also posted on X that Robeson said Trump was a drag on the Republican Party days after the 2022 midterm elections. While Trump's pre-endorsement caused outrage among the most extreme right-wing political figures, several far-from-moderate Republican lawmakers applauded it, including House Speaker Pro Tem Travis Granthen of Gilbert and State Representative Teresa Martinez of Casa Grande. The responses to those showings of support were less than supportive. Bad idea, one ex-user wrote to Granthen. No, rejected, wrote another. She will not get my vote. Clearly, the Republican establishment wants this woman elected governor, wrote a third. I hope we get an unquestionable MAGA candidate. If the candidate Trump wants is not a MAGA candidate, then who is? The program continues with this story written by Stephen Lemons and posted on December 21st. Mesa man busted for bug spraying Walmart fruit filmed other, quote, pranks. When all you care about is going viral, sometimes you can wind up in jail. That's what happened to 27-year-old wannabe influencer Charles Smith, a.k.a. Wolfie Party. On December 19th, Smith posted a video of himself taking a can of Hot Shot Ultra Bedbug and Flea Killer off the shelf of the Stapley Drive Walmart in Mesa and dousing fruit, vegetables, and rotisserie chickens with the pesticide. Now, after turning himself in to Mesa police, he faces criminal charges over the stunt. Mesa Police Detective Richard Encinas told Phoenix New Times that Smith was booked into Maricopa County Jail around 12:30 a.m. on one felony count of introducing poison to food. Smith also faces misdemeanor charges for theft, endangerment, and criminal damage. Encinas could not say if Smith had been arraigned or granted bail. According to police, Smith turned himself in after they phoned him about the video, which no longer appears on Smith's Wolfie Party Instagram account, which has 368,000 followers. It has since been posted to Reddit. It shows Smith, his head clad in a pink do-rag, as he sprays rows of bananas, lemons, potatoes, tomatoes, and finally, an upright stand of rotisserie chickens. Thankfully for the police, Smith made sure to film his face before doing the deed. After being Mirandized, Smith copped to the crime, per the police report, supposedly admitting that if someone ate the tainted food, they could become ill and may even have to go to the hospital. He claimed he could earn $6,000 to $10,000 monthly for doing these types of pranks as a troll on social media. Smith has an outstanding warrant in Tempe, according to the Mesa Police report, and past arrests for shoplifting, theft, and making false reports. None of which is surprising, based on the content of his Instagram and TikTok accounts, which show Smith apparently engaged in all kinds of petty mischief, some of it possibly illegal. In two videos posted to his Wolfie Caletti TikTok account, which has 330,000 followers, Smith wraps bike locks and bungee cords around the door handles to the entranceways to retail establishments during business hours, effectively locking in shoppers and employees. In another, he takes a mannequin head from a mall display, runs to a fast food restaurant, jumps the counter, heads to the kitchen, and places the plastic noggin in a fryer. In a video on his Instagram account, Smith scopes out a senior citizen drying his clothes at a laundromat. When the elderly male abandons the dryer, Smith adds raw bacon and eggs to the guy's clothes and turns the dryer back on. Other videos by Smith show him pulling a fire alarm at a Wendy's, throwing food from the second tier at a mall onto people walking below, harassing some dude in a male restroom with a pair of tighty-whities smeared with what looks like feces, and tossing what he alleges to be a dead pigeon into a fryer at a fast food joint. Some of the videos seem obviously staged with the assistance of friends or associates. A few are actually amusing, like one where Smith walks into the back room of a Walmart, waving a raw fish and telling employees to inform management that he's quitting. In another, Smith fries up some bacon and eggs in a skillet, then heads to a local mall where he offers the skillet to a surprised man seated in a courtyard. There's even a video where Smith dons a witch's hat and seems to fly through the air with a maniacal laugh, finally alighting in the back of yet another fast food establishment where he places a small pumpkin in a fryer. What exactly Smith has against fast food eateries and retail stores is unknown, but at least he's not really hurting anyone in those videos. On the header of his TikTok account, Smith labels himself a tycoon creator and supreme villain. But his last self-assigned epithet seems most accurate: will never be famous. Well, at least not for the right reasons. Next, this obituary written by Paul Coro and posted on December 23rd. What Dick Van Arsdale, Phoenix's firstborn son, meant to Valley Hoops. Life changes forever after the firstborn, and that's how it was for Phoenix basketball. Dick Van Arsdale was the first Phoenix Sun when the franchise joined the NBA in 1968. He took their first steps when he drove for a layup for the Suns' first points. He matured into their first NBA All-Star, grew up to be part of their first playoff team, and became the sage for one of their first NBA Finals teams and in later franchise roles. Van Arsdale lived 37 of his 81 years as a face and fixture of the franchise, whether he was the Suns' highly skilled and strongly willed player, a bright broadcaster, a learn-on-the-fly coach, or the talent-tabbing executive. The original Sun, and the franchise's forever Sun, passed away on December 16th. He left lasting legacies and touchstones in the memories of Suns fans, as well as the base blocks that built a burgeoning sports town. When Van Arsdale was selected by then-Suns general manager Jerry Colangelo in the 1968 NBA expansion draft, he said he doubted it would be a turning point for his career. When he arrived on a 118-degree day in Phoenix, he hated the city. But it was love at first sight for Phoenix and its firstborn son. The mutually beneficial love affair lasted 47 years. It went well beyond Van Arsdale's 9 seasons as a Suns player, which included 3 All-Star seasons that helped put his number 5 in the Veterans Memorial Coliseum rafters alongside Connie Hawkins' number 42. My only regret was not being able to win the NBA championship, Van Arsdale said upon retirement, not knowing he would get as close as any Suns great has in 56 seasons. Van Arsdale turned to art after a death-defying stroke in 2005, and his storybook start in basketball was like a scene he would have drawn. Dick and his twin brother Tom Van Arsdale were born 15 minutes apart and grew up near Indianapolis, battling on a backyard dirt court with 2 pieces of wood nailed to a tree as their hoops backboard. Fraternal fisticuffs formed 2 players who were identical beyond looks. Dick and Tom grew up equal in just about everything, from grade point averages to scoring averages. They shared Indiana's Mr. Basketball honors. Each scored 17 points per game at Indiana University and were drafted consecutively into the NBA. Only as pros were they first separated, with Dick going 13th to New York and Tom picked 14th by Detroit. With blonde hair, blue eyes, and jawlines as ruggedly strong as their play, Life magazine photos of the twins drew a Warner Brothers 7-year contract offer while they were Hoosiers juniors. Van Arsdale's declined, but their pro basketball lives still led them to starring in a Miller Lite commercial, arguing less filling versus tastes great, before debating who was Dick and who was Tom. They were more bashing than dashing on the court. Those backyard brawls formed styles that were predicated on defense and drives. Their perimeter shots developed as pros and helped each twin make three All-Star games. They remained the best NBA brothers until Mark and Pau Gasol came along more than 30 years later. A son's career begins. After the 1968 expansion draft, Van Arsdale went from teaming with Hall of Fame players like Walt Frazier and Willis Reed in New York to playing in Phoenix alongside Hall of Famers Gail Goodrich and Hawkins. The Flying Dutchman won over new pro basketball fans in Phoenix with relentless drives, an array of shots, and a competitive fire. Eventually, as familiar as the sunburst on the sides of the uniform's shorts, Van Arsdale racked up 12,060 points as a Sun, the most in franchise history until Walter Davis broke his record. In that NBA era, Van Arsdale was the rare non-center who could shoot 50% from the field while averaging 20 points per game and also be an NBA All-Defensive Team honoree. Van Arsdale extended his Phoenix basketball career beyond his playing years with a sense of humor and savvy. He suggested switching jerseys with Tom at an NBA All-Star game. Did they? It's anyone's guess. In his final Sun season, the brothers were reunited when Tom joined the Suns, the duo's only pro season together. Van Arsdale traded sneakers for a headset, serving as a Suns broadcasting analyst for 15 years alongside late legend Al McCoy. When the Suns fired coach John McLeod in 1987, Colangelo turned to Van Arsdale to finish the season as interim coach. He figured that out too, starting 4-11 and ending on a 10-1 run. Van Arsdale preferred a front office role and became the vice president of player personnel when Colangelo formed an ownership group to buy the Suns in 1987. He remained a part of the Suns basketball executive team until his 2005 stroke. An extra blood vessel sustained his brain's blood supply when his wife, Barbara, found him speechless at their home patio door. He retained his motor skills to draw, drive, and fly fish, but Van Arsdale went through a rigorous rehabilitation program to regain limited speech. The twins could always finish each other's thoughts, but now Dick needed Tom to do so. A father of two and grandfather of four, Dick turned to his detailed pen and ink art and eventually partnered with Tom to open Van Arsdale Art Studio in Old Town Scottsdale, where the brothers spent their days in skillful art and playful arguments. Dick remained a Phoenix fixture, visible for Ring of Honor ceremonies or Scottsdale strolls. During his son's years, Van Arsdale opened an Air Force recruitment commercial by saying, "Basketball's been good to me." And he was great for Phoenix. The Year of Z. This is Arizona's top new cannabis strain of 2024. This next story was written by Zach Newman and posted on December 24th. In the diverse world of cannabis, consumers have countless strains from which to choose. The flavor spectrum is vast, ranging from earthy OG strains to fruity Tropicana varieties, catering to any palate. Blue Blitz, Tropical Z, Jealousy, and Biscotti were among the award-winning strains at this year's Earl Cup in Arizona. At last year's High Times, strains such as Frosted Donuts, Cheetah Piss, Bad Apple, and Super Boof received high scores. These winning strains are known for their fruity and tropical flavors and aromas, indicating a shift in consumer preference from traditional earthy kush to more vibrant, candy-like strains. All are welcome additions to the market. But for the best new strain in Arizona in 2024, Phoenix New Times is selecting Zacatlas. The Zacatlas strain has been around for nearly a decade, but this year it made its way to Arizona. It's now available from Alien Labs. Last year, during Spanibus, the largest cannabis event in Europe, Zacatlas was one of the top trending strains, per Leafly. Many of the other highest-ranked strains had Zacatlas genetics. The hype was real. Zacatlas genetic seeds sold for 350 euros per pack during the event. The Indica dominant hybrid was a result of breeding two iconic strains, Grape Ape and Grapefruit. Expect an aroma that hits you with notes of grape candy, tropical fruits, lavender, ginger, skunk, and diesel. It contains high amounts of several beneficial compounds, helping the strain capture honors for Top Indica at several Cannabis Cup competitions throughout California and Michigan, and at the 2016 Emerald Cup. Due to Zacatlas' desirable flavor traits, it has been pivotal in breeding new genetics and is parent to many variants, including Blue Zacatlas, Watermelon Zacatlas, Zacatlas Cake, Tropical Zacatlas, Cherry Zacatlas, Zacatlas Crasher, Zacatlas Pie, Zangria, Z-Cubed, and Zushi. These variants currently are available in Arizona dispensaries, along with the original Zacatlas. The commercial cannabis industry needed to point the consumer somewhere, and the candy purple genetics were able to be easily produced with shorter flowering times, said Matthew Bloom, co-founder of Grow Sciences, one of the largest cultivations in the Arizona market. Grow Sciences has hopped on the Z train. Next year is the year of Zacatlas, Bloom said, and we are currently in production of our Zacatlas Cubed. Zacatlas isn't just tasty, it's also great for calming stress and anxiety. Many people use it for its relaxing effects, which can boost mood and help with discomfort. Its balanced CBD and THC levels make it a popular choice for easing muscle tension and promoting a sense of calm. Strains often represent names inspired by famous products, such as Girl Scout cookies and Gorilla Glue. These catchy names have sparked legal battles, yet many smaller growers stick to the classic names, even though these strains slowly evolve through crossbreeding and rebranding. Zacatlas' journey follows a similar path. Recently, the creators of the Zacatlas strain encountered legal trouble from Mars Wrigley, the company behind Skittles, forcing them to change the name to the original Z. However, many growers still produce strains under the Zacatlas name. Alien Labs rebranded their flower simply as Z. Dubbed the best-tasting strain on planet Earth by several Reddit users, Zacatlas is a must-try if you can find it. The next time you're shopping, ask your bud tender to show you the latest Zacatlas crosses available. Next, writer Robert R. Pella brings us 6 vintage Christmas albums for people who love the classics. This story was posted on December 25th. I've tried listening to contemporary Christmas music. No, really. I downloaded the Holiday Collection by CeeLo Green, and I streamed Pentatonix's Christmas Is Here. There's an MP3 file folder on my laptop called Hip New Holiday Music, with a copy of the She and Him Holiday Collection, as well as Ariana Grande's Christmas and Chill, which I made it through almost half of. When it comes to holiday records, I'm a failure at keeping current. I want to like Tori Kelly singing Let It Snow with Babyface, or The 12 Days of Bristmas by OMB Bloodbath, but to me, they sound like they're playing at holiday cheer. Conversely, I find nothing but warm Yuletide sincerity in the grooves of Christmas albums by Barbra Streisand and Bob Dylan, both Jewish. But when it comes to holiday music, I want mine on a slab of 60-year-old vinyl I found in a thrift shop, and not a newfangled 180-gram reissue, or a digital download, or an MP3. I want some boozy old lounge singer crooning Adesta Fidelis, and not an auto-tuned teenager trying to sell Silent Night. Sorry. My musical holiday taste seems to be mired in the mid-60s, the heyday of the Christmas album, probably because I was a kid back then, and many of my best holiday memories reside in my childhood past. And it occurs to me that if I'm trying to find a holiday download I like as much as I love 1963's The Jack Jones Christmas Album, maybe you're looking for a list of middle-of-the-last-century platters that'll give your Yuletide a new sound. Here, in that holiday spirit, are a half dozen of my Christmas faves. The Ventures, Christmas Album, 1965. It's surf rock sleigh bells with a reverb crazy twist. This influential instrumental group grafted popular hits of the day onto arrangements of familiar holiday tunes. The record kicks off with a reference to the band's biggest hit, Walk Don't Run, that slides into a kitschy riff on Sleigh Ride. Kiddie favorites like Santa Claus is Coming to Town and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer get groovy backbones from Wooly Bully and The Beatles' I Feel Fine, respectively, while Frosty the Snowman meets The Champs' Tequila with high holiday style. Don't miss the Nashville-flavored call and response of Silver Bells, a sleepy duet of Moog and electric guitar. Lena Horne, Mary from Lena. There are singers whose voices are built for the emotional pitch and campy mischief of holiday songs, and Horne is among their number. Her five-piece combo puts real zip into some Christmas chestnuts, and her rendition of Frank Lesser's What Are You Doing New Year's Eve is rich and warm, and maybe second only to Edie Gourmet's. Horne's jazzy riff on Jingle Bells, renamed Jingle All the Way, is a left-of-center blues hall rendition that's a real winner. She even convinced me to like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, whom she casts as a naughty young buck with a drinking problem. Don't miss Horne's finger-poppin' spin on Let It Snow, which revives that snoozy number. Burt Camfort, Christmas Wonderland, 1963. Composer and orchestra leader Camfort pioneered the genre that's become known as cocktail music, all of it symphonic and arranged around vibes and a signature sound of drunken trumpet solos. Here he goes nuts with holiday fare. Santa Claus is Coming to Town, done as an upright bass-driven shuffle. I Hear the Bells, a delightfully jangly brass band party. The maestro's original work is a 1-2 punch of Yuletide originality. His Holiday for Bells is a joyful jump laced with Yumasumac-like sirens wailing in the background vocals. And both the crazy cheerful Toy Parade and Jingo Django sound like main title music for every Rankin-Bass holiday special ever filmed. Don't miss, the title song answers the musical question, what does an inebriated trumpet sound like? And should become the official anthem of day after holiday hangovers. The Ray Conniff Singers, Christmas with Conniff, 1959. It's all about vocal arrangements with Conniff on this, the first of his several kicky Christmas collections. The virtuoso bandleader brings us a bag full of close harmonies, double-tracked countertenors, and mezzo-sopranos singing scale-jumping fills. He also brings us Christmas Bride, the all-time creepiest original holiday composition, a solemn number in which an obviously horny guy asks Santa Claus to bring him a wife for Christmas. Make her my bride for Christmas, Santa. It wouldn't cost very much. Yikes. It was 1959, but still. Don't miss Here Comes Santa Claus is all vibes, echo chamber vocal tricks, and nutty ad-libs. But again, Christmas Bride. Doris Day, the Doris Day Christmas album, 1964. I thought I was tired of Silver Bells and sick to death of Winter Wonderland until I stumbled on this stylish collection of Christmas tunes. Day does things with lesser-known beauties like Snowfall and Toyland, and, ever the class act, skips the kiddie classics altogether. There are no Frosties or Santas here. Don't miss. Where did Christmas Present come from, and why haven't other singers covered it? Sidney Robbins' elegant ballad is the perfect showcase for Day's lovely vibrato. Glen Campbell, That Christmas Feeling, 1968. This collection sneaks up on you, its material divided evenly among holiday classics, little-known charmers, and stunning original compositions, all underplayed by former session guy and recent superstar Campbell. He makes new stuff like It Must Be Getting Close to Christmas and Christmas Is for Children sound like classics, and sells Roger Miller's Old Toy Trains as if it were his own. Among the standards is a gorgeous take on There's No Place Like Home, reworked for Christmas by no less than Sammy Kahn. Don't miss, covering Willie Nelson's Pretty Paper is a risk that pays off for Campbell here in an Al DeLore arrangement that turns a schmaltzy waltz into a sonic masterpiece. Next on the program, this story written by Jennifer Goldberg, posted on December 26th. Phoenix Art Museum to debut Anna Sui fashion exhibition in April. The rock and roll inspired clothing by one of the greatest American fashion designers will be heading to the Valley this spring. On April 13th, Phoenix Art Museum will open The World of Anna Sui, a blockbuster fashion exhibition. The show, which comes to the Valley from the Fashion and Textile Museum in London, comprises more than 100 ensembles, including looks from Sui's personal archive, fashions from her newest collection, and various objects and ensembles from the museum's renowned fashion collection, selected in collaboration with the designer. Anna Sui defined a fashion generation, and Phoenix Art Museum is pleased to present The World of Anna Sui, exploring the impact of this extraordinary designer. Jeremy Michalazik, the Sybil Harrington director and CEO of Phoenix Art Museum, said in the exhibition announcement. In the 1990s, Anna Sui was one of the driving forces behind the decade's now iconic style, many of which inspire today's Gen Z trends. Ever since, she has continued to shape the fashion landscape, building an elaborate, imaginative universe that draws inspiration from grunge music, goth aesthetics, romanticism, and more. Sui, 60, launched her brand in the late 1970s. Her output now includes books, fragrances, beauty, and home decor, in addition to clothing and accessories. Her creative vision has earned her countless accolades, including earning the Jeffrey Bean Lifetime Achievement Award from the Council of Fashion Designers of America in 2009. Anna Sui is a self-taught historian of culture, art, and fashion, and a true master at threading narratives and aesthetics from seemingly conflicting genres into her designs. Helen Jean, the museum's Jacques Dorance curator of fashion, said in the announcement. Visitors to the exhibition will discover how her work samples elements of popular music, books, movies, and art movements, while referencing wide-ranging fashion trends from sportswear to army surplus jackets to Japanese hankies and kipao dresses. The World of Anna Sui is a pure visual delight with incredible pop culture history woven throughout, and is yet another powerful opportunity to see how fashion designers absorb, reference, and engage with the defining styles and social movements of our collective past and present. The World of Anna Sui will run at Phoenix Art Museum from April 13th to September 28th. And as we approach the end of this week's program, here's a quick look at a review of Billie Eilish's Phoenix concert, which was visually, musically stunning. The review was written by Kelly Walsh and was posted on December 25th. On December 13th, Billie Eilish performed a sold-out show at Desert Diamond Arena in Glendale, delivering a night that was equal parts emotionally charged, visually stunning, and socially conscious. From her opening moments to the final note, Eilish's raw and stunning vocals and mesmerizing expressions captivated the full attention of the audience throughout the entire night. When Eilish took the stage, her entrance itself was a marvel. A massive LED screen acted as a canopy, descending to create immersive visuals, while a floor screen added a further interactive element. The crowd erupted as Eilish appeared, standing center stage with a radiant smile, asking, "Are you ready to have some fun?" Eilish masterfully balanced high-energy hits with intimate moments. One of the night's most powerful moments came during TV, when the crowd screamed the lyric while they're overturning Roe v. Wade. And after the song, she reminded female attendees they were safe and seen. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. Remember that if you missed any of the stories in this program or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them both on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on On Demand Podcasts, scroll down to the program you're interested in, and click on Listen.